Today on Against the Grain, the right is in great disarray these days, propelled by the unexpected popularity of presidential candidate Donald Trump. But its successes have been remarkable. As Doug Henwood points out, at mid-century, the right was marginal in American politics, wild-eyed birchers wandering in the wilderness while the business class had firmly accommodated itself to the New Deal. I'm Sasha Lilly. Henwood will join me to talk about the confluence of resentments and constituencies that fueled the rise of the right. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The right has been on the march for at least the last four decades in the United States, fueled by the aggrieved sense that the social gains of the past have been a disaster for Americans. And while the Republican establishment is in crisis right now, the right as a movement seems as energized as ever, despite the lack of substantial threats from the left, its typical foil. Today's guest, Doug Henwood, was a youthful member of the right before moving far to the left. He's reflected on the rise of the right in a new essay in the Socialist Register, where he traces the history and constituencies of the right, its elite backers and rank-and-file members. He's editor of the Left Business Observer and hosts the program Behind the News on Pacifica Radio. So, Doug, if the right tends to surge in opposition to threats from the left, how then should we understand the momentum of the right in recent years?
Yeah, well, I don't really fully understand it. Corey Robin had his book on the right with largely that thesis that the right sort of parasitically derives its energy from the energy of the left and appropriates a lot of its language and spirit of revolution, like the Freudian superego derives power from the id. But, you know, there is absolutely no left insurgency visible, or at least until maybe fairly recently. But the right has been on the march now for decades. It seemed to me that they won a pretty definitive victory in the early 1980s, consolidated it in the 1990s, but they haven't stopped. The only thing explanation that makes any sense is that there's still some residual aspects of the welfare state in the U.S. They haven't yet privatized Social Security and ended Medicare. In Britain, we see the Cameron government trying to roll back a lot of the British welfare state and maybe moving to privatize the National Health Service. So it seems like as if they want a total and final victory. That's the only thing that I can see as really pushing them with the energy that they've got. But the phantasmic assertions that you hear coming from the right sometimes are very bizarre. You know, all the claims about Obama being some sort of Kenyan socialist and a raving anti-imperialist and all this business and on the verge of nationalizing this and that, and it's just fantastic. I don't know where they get these ideas, but it seems... perhaps because Obama's not white, perhaps because he has an unusual name by WASPy standards. There does seem to be some phantasmic portion of it, but that's come along with a remarkable intellectual devolution. When I was on the right briefly in the early 1970s, we were intellectual snobs and very proud of it. To see what passes for a discourse on the right now is just an appalling decline. They do have the energy and they do have the power.
Given that we're going to spend the hour talking about the right, who actually is the right? Like when we say the right, it conjures up the Republican Party, but that's not the extent of it. And then there's also questions of the leadership and the rank and file. So who's the right?
Well, that's interesting now watching that right sort of coming apart under the influence of Donald Trump. He has certain conservative aspects, but certain populist aspects. He's very hard to classify politically. He's certainly not a movement conservative. Certainly the most appealing candidate to the movement conservatives probably now would be, Cruz, but he is a rather crude figure. Rand Paul flopped and demonstrating once again that libertarianism is not a very popular philosophy. But it's fascinating to watch the classic right just throw fits over the success of Donald Trump. National Review, which has a certain status as one of the leading journals of the intellectual right for some 60 years, devoted a special issue to denouncing the threat of Trump and trying to mobilize its army to defeat the guy because he just really didn't fit their bill. But historically, the base of the right has been well, if we want to talk about the base within the ruling class or the elites, has been a provincial petty bourgeoisie. And if we go back into the 50s, when the New Deal consensus seemed very, very solid and unbreachable, the funding for what little right wing there was then came out of, I don't know, just, you know, caricature might be a owner of a small machine tool plant in suburban Illinois somewhere. These people are far from the metropolitan centers, not at the core of big capital, but rich people with money to throw around, but not really politically members of the elite. And they're the ones who funded a lot of things like from the John Birch Society to other aspects of movement conservatism. But when William Buckley was starting National Review, he had a hard time raising money. You know, he would go around to business people and tell them, you know, that they needed to fight the forces of socialism represented by the New Deal. They were in the 50s. They were facing Eisenhower, who had pretty much made peace with the innovations of the 1930s, and he had a hard time shaking any money out of them. He, as he put it at the time, it seemed that business people were not very interested in saving capitalism. Then, obviously, the right got more and more influential in the following decades. But still, the base was very much outside of those elites, at least until it got much more powerful in the 1980s. So, yeah, I guess I would say that was the base within the upper reaches of society would be that provincial petty bourgeoisie.
So it raises the question, what's the relationship between the right and the ruling class? Some people might assume that the ruling class, by definition, is part of the right. But it seems like what you're saying is that it's a bit more complicated than that.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons that Eisenhower had made peace with the New Deal was that basically big capital had. Big business could afford to pay the higher wages that came with unionization. The auto industry in particular, you know, was something of an oligopoly, three big firms. They made peace with the UAW in the late 1940s and in return for a deal where the unions would stay out of management, and in return, the workers got steady cost of living increases every year, and just an improved pay packet reliably. Smaller businesses couldn't really pay that. They were under competitive pressure. They didn't have all the money that the likes of GM had, and they were resolutely anti-union. But they were not the dominant force politically in the 50s and into the 1960s. So if you look at some of the people around Eisenhower, they all had, many of his advisors had ties to big business, Eisenhower is perfectly comfortable with big labor. They had this kind of tripartite arrangement. Big business, big labor, and big government had come to be a holy trinity of the American ruling elite. There were discontents under the surface, but there was no broad ruling class desire to change things. I think some people remembered both the Depression a lot of the labor unrest that followed World War II and decided, well, let's just opt for peace and stability and not try to roll back the New Deal in any meaningful way. Like I said, there were these dissident business people who would have liked to roll that back, but there was no strong support for it. And that continued well into the 1970s, really. I remember when I was briefly on the right in the early 1970s, it was a very lonely thing. There was a party, the right at Yale, to which I belonged, and there were maybe between a dozen and 20 regular people regularly at meetings. It was not a very popular thing. We were considered bizarre almost countercultural in 1971-72. That would change by the end of the decade, but right, you know, before the recessions of 1970s, the right was really a very marginal force in American political and intellectual life.
Right. So then what changed? Because the 1960s are seen as this pivotal moment, and then there's the backlash in all sorts of ways to the changes wrought by the 60s, civil rights, women's liberation, among others. But are you saying that for the right, the more pivotal moment was the capitalist crisis of the early 70s?
Well, I think that's what changed a lot of the attitude of what's loosely called the business community. Of course, there was a change at the popular level beginning in the late 1960s with all those rebellions that you talk about, the Black Civil Rights Revolution, the feminist upsurge, gay rights, growing critique of all the received wisdom of American life, and a general sense that things were spinning out of control had an effect on a lot of people, urban, white, working class, rural whites were all very disturbed by this, and you know that's when you see the rise of people like George Wallace, the appeal of Richard Nixon. But business didn't really mobilize till a little later, when inflation started rising and profits started falling, and the financial markets did very badly throughout the 1970s. That's when things started shifting.
Well, I want to ask you more about the backlash too. The changes of the 60s, but just staying with the business class for a moment, how were their fortunes changing within, say, the Republican Party itself? Because there were shifts that were happening in terms of who had money, where they were located, and what industries they were based around.
Yeah, well, the Republican Party into the 1970s was dominated by a Northeastern elite of WASPs with roots in traditional big manufacturing and investment banking and commercial banking. With the rise of inflation in the 1970s and also a movement to get away from high-cost regions of production, you saw a growth in the South and the West, the so-called Sun Belt. And also the creation of new fortunes with the explosion in energy and other commodity prices in the 1970s. You saw the creation of a whole new wave of fortunes that were much more right-wing in their political instincts and much less inclined to the kind of peacemaking that the old line big WASP money used to be. So those old WASP fortunes started dwindling. They were done in by inflation and getting sliced more thinly with each generation of inheritance. And then you saw the rise of people like, you know, the Hunts and other oil fortunes in Texas and in Southern California that then led to a shift in the nature of wouldn't call them ruling class yet. I want to make a distinction between people who are merely rich and people who have political power. But you saw a rise of a new rich that was angling for that political power. And they were really moving within the Republican Party. There was, of course, the 1964 Goldwater effort nomination, but that failed. He got badly shellacked in the 1964 election. And the right retreated for a bit. But, you know, if you look at the movement of the right wing to the Republican Party from the 50s to their final triumph with the election of Reagan in 1980, it was a long, long struggle by people who really had some strategy and some philosophy and some passion. And, you know, you see nothing comparable like that on the left today at all. I mean, there's just no long-term vision, no passion, no strategy, no unity. It's remarkable to watch to look back at how the right took over the Republican Party. Some of them were, you know, actually alums of communist movements. There were some ex-Trotskyists, ex-Communist Party people, who used what they learned in their experience on the left, the ideological discipline, the organizational discipline, the willingness to make sacrifices in the short term for gains in the long term. They learned a lot from their Bolshevik past and had a lot to do with the right's takeover of the Republican Party. It took a long time, but several decades, but they accomplished their mission.
That's the voice of Doug Henwood, editor of the Left Business Observer. He has an essay in the latest Socialist Register on the American right. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. So you were just discussing how the elites aligned themselves with the right and how the elites were in flux. Returning to the dislocations of the 60s, the enormous gains for all sorts of people were registered as losses for others. And race was a crucial one in that. How important is that in this story of understanding the right then and now in terms of a driving force that has fueled especially the right as a movement?
Well, I think it's very important in several dimensions. There's certainly a lot of white people, particularly of medium to low social status, who felt that the one thing they had in life, their rights as white people, were being trampled upon. But there was also a way in which liberals kind of helped in that, for example, it played the New York City Mayor John Lindsay, a WASP of the old school. Was very sympathetic to black New Yorkers and had a pretty good bond with them, but didn't really care about white working classes in the outer boroughs. He ran the city materially in the interests of the usual real estate finance coalition that runs this city. So there was something material basis to the white resentment of the liberal elites. So when Bill Buckley ran for mayor of New York in 1965, which, by the way, he did consciously to damage liberal republicanism. He wanted to destroy liberal republicanism and was willing to see the election of a Democrat to accomplish that goal. You know, it's amazing how liberals now will do anything to avoid a loss. They don't think of what they can do to accomplish longer-term goals. But Buckley was able to tap into the white resentment and got many more votes than he expected because of the resentment of what Lindsay had stood for. But I would also say, and I owe this point to Corey Robin, there was also the issue of feminism, which had an effect at the household level, that a lot of men resented the erosion of their patriarchal privilege in the house. They were no longer the king of the castle, that role was under challenge. So that was a personal dimension to that popular backlash, in addition to the broad sense of insults to white privilege.
Right. And of course, there's the whole question of the Southern strategy, where conservative white Southerners left the Democratic Party for the Republican Party in the 1970s, as the Republicans phrased their messages in very racially coded ways. But one thing that I wanted to ask you is, in terms of all of these changes that then created resentment amongst those who might be lower on down on the social hierarchy, but at the same time had traditionally had privileges through being white and being male. To what degree do we know how that group broke down? I mean, to say lower classes, geographically, there's obviously some sense of where people lived, but is there more information too? Is this just simply the white working class? Can it be broken down any more about urban and suburban, small business owners versus wage earners?
Well, one thing that happened was that Kevin Phillips, the architect of Nixon's Southern strategy, said that the key to politics was learning who hates whom. And he and Nixon were able to play that up very, very cynically and successfully. But the people that Kevin Phillips mentioned weren't just the white Southerners who the Southern strategy appealed to, but, as he put it, the people who live at the end of the subway lines, that is the white urban working class, which felt very neglected by the urban renewal moves in the 1960s and the anti-poverty programs. You saw at the same time, in the 1970s, the development of a new class within the Democratic base, as people professional managerial sorts who lived in tonier suburbs. They were very conscious that they were not going to be like the gray flannel suit boring suburbanites of the 1950s. These were highly educated professional managerial class people who thought themselves above all that. And they moved into positions of power within the Democratic Party, so that the old urban working class base of the Democrats was really shunted aside in favor of this new social formation, the suburban elites. And we see that now to this day. There's a story in the New York Times recently quoting the former governor of Pennsylvania, Ed Rendell, as saying that their strategy as they face the threat of Donald Trump is to give up on maybe those blue-collar Democrats and embrace even more aggressively moderate Republicans in suburbs of places like Cincinnati and Columbus, Ohio. So that is something that's also happened. There was that change in the Democratic base and a real, even a hostility developing towards the old urban working class base, which they came last in the views of the Democratic elites. And Republicans were able very successfully to play on that popular resentment.
Well, perhaps as a result of the racist and sexist politics that some white working class people embraced, the left also, in many ways, ended up seeing these people as unredeemable. And a lot of that had to do with a sense that the working class was sort of constituted by Archie Bunkers, conservative people who would have been pro-war. And there's certainly a whole way that the working classes of the 70s, especially the white working class, is remembered. To what degree is that accurate? Because, of course, that was also a time of a lot of working class militancy.
Yeah, well, the 70s are a very interesting period. And, you know, it's obviously it's a fashionable topic of study now by social scientists and political scientists for many reasons. My friend Penny Lewis did a book a couple of years ago showing that this myth that the working class was pro-war and the elites were anti-war is really very misplaced. The working class was far more anti-war than they get credit for in historical memory. But the caricature took hold. The hard hats of the early 1970s who won in a riot beating up anti-war hippies in lower Manhattan were embraced by Richard Nixon as symbolic of this new model of the working class. The union leadership also under George Meany was just not at all interested in dealing with the changes of the 1970s. Someone around Meany, a Meany associate, said of the 1972 Democratic convention, there was too much long hair and not enough cigars for their taste. And you know, there was that cultural conflict. But the reactionary turn of the white working class at that point was greatly exaggerated. The 70s were a time of, you know, the cliche was the blue collar blues. There was a tremendous amount of discontent about work, especially in the early 1970s. A lot of the changes in the 1960s hit the working class in the 1970s. Drug use and a bad attitude in general spread very rapidly into the working class population. That alarmed elites tremendously, and they did their best to try to repress it. But it took the recession of the mid-1970s, followed by the deep recession of the late 70s into the early 1980s, really to break that spirit of the working class and lead to a real right-wing victory.
Well, I want to ask you a bit more about the Democratic Party in this story. Where do we situate them? Because within the classic dichotomy in American politics, the Republican Party is the party of the right. The Democratic Party is the party of the center-left. But that's just not accurate at all. When one thinks of people in the Democratic Party today, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, you know, the most accurate way would be to locate them on the center right. How do we think about the Democratic Party in this larger story of the American right?
If you go back in the 1950s, there was not that much difference between the two parties. They both had liberal wings, conservative wings. In many ways, the Republican Party was more friendly to civil liberties and civil rights. The Democrats had their large Southern Dixiecrat component. Very often civil rights legislation in the 1950s into the 1960s, you'd get more Republican votes for it in Congress than you would Democratic votes. That changed over time. But the idea that the Republicans and Democrats could be represent some left and right of the political spectrum is very wrong going back 50, 60 years. But then the right moved to take over the Republican Party and purge the liberals like Lindsay. It took them several decades, but they finally succeeded. The Democrats did something similar starting in the 1980s as they purged whatever, you know, the remnants of the New Deal, social democratic civil rights wing of the party. Moved under the direction of Bill Clinton and the DLC into a more business-friendly, tough on crime, end welfare, be tough with the military, military stance. So,
and what do you mean by purged?
The Democratic Party just became, you know, they changed the rules of nomination to favor candidates that were more business friendly. They created this whole system of superdelegates to give the party machinery, the party leaders, more power in choosing candidates. Clinton, you know, made it. If you look back into the early 1990s, there were definitely fears of crime and resentment of welfare. And rather than turning leftward for any solution to those challenges, they really turned rightward. And it did have some, you know, popular resonance. You have to admit that, Clinton was able to get some votes in the South. The fear of crime was large in a lot of urban areas, some of it phantasmic, you know, people who didn't really have that much to worry about crime nonetheless worried about it, but they were able to bring in a whole new set of concerns and policies into the Democratic agenda. There was also that change, as I was saying earlier, in the composition of the party, the growth of this suburban professional managerial class came to be numerically more important to the Democratic coalition, and the interests of the poorer and working class members of the party just became eclipsed. And of course, the people with the money were able to dominate the agenda because they were able to dominate the financing machinery of the party.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Doug Henwood about the American right. He has an essay in the latest edition of the Socialist Register, and we have a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org. He's the host of the weekly program Behind the News and editor of the Left Business Observer. His most recent book is My Turn, about Hillary Clinton. What has been the effects of the right on the left and on liberalism? This whole right-wing backlash, you know, you were suggesting that the right was very forward-thinking when they were their years in the wilderness in the 1940s, the 1950s. They looked far ahead with a plan to try to come roaring back, and remarkably did so and stayed so since. What has the consequence of all of that been for both liberalism and for the left?
Before I answer that, I should say that the business elite, the real metropolitan business elite, didn't embrace right-wing politics until later in the 70s, under the influence of all the inflation and the decline in profitability and the sense that things are just spinning out of control. So, for example, Citibank chair Walter Wriston, from the 70s and 80s, said that at first people like him were not very convinced by Ronald Reagan. They were suspicious of him, thought he was just an actor with strange politics. But he convinced them, and they came around. And so there's this developing class consciousness within the ruling class about the need to come up with a broad political agenda of transformation. So, you know, the push towards deregulation and privatization, and generally what we think of as neoliberalism, really got going as the 70s turned into the 80s because of that turn among the business elite. They were uncommonly united for a brief period of time in a broad political agenda. That all fell apart when that broad unity fell apart with victory, but they really pushed things very, very hard for you know, I don't know, 5 or 10 years as the 70s became the 80s. But the Democrats have historically always been only compromised, it seems, with the right. I came across a piece that Hal Draper wrote. can't remember where it appeared, but he wrote it in the late 1960s about how the Democrats would always say, oh, we've got the liberal and labor votes in our pockets, so we might as well compromise with the right. And that's what they've been doing, you know, for many, many decades. Draper's piece, you could publish it today with just a few names changed. But as the right got righter and more angry and more militant, they exerted ever-increasing pressure on the Democrats to do the same. They never thought of challenging the right from the left. They always thought that they were going to compromise. So we had this endless dance of lesser evilism where, as the Republicans moved righter, the Democrats essentially say, well, we're not quite as bad as them, and hope that they would get the liberal and labor votes that way, and the working class votes that way. And it hasn't really been very successful for the Democratic base, at least the less well-off portion of the Democratic base. But they keep doing that, and we're seeing this in the current campaign. We're seeing, remarkably, Hillary Clinton and many of her surrogates and her House intellectuals all arguing against social democracy. It's just been amazing to see people like Paul Krugman writing pieces saying that we just can't have single payer health insurance. It's been fascinating to watch how the Sanders challenge from the left and the unexpected popularity of it forced the Democrat mainstream to come out as really anti-social democratic. And I think that's always been underlying their sense of compromise. They always wanted to be good members of the ruling class and do anything that was going to increase the security or power or welfare of the working class. But they were always much more coy about it than they've been lately. Now they've just become totally frank about it. They just don't want it. They're really trying to get people to look. You know, we've watched them beat down expectations for 30 or 35 years, but apparently they're not low enough and need to be beaten down further. And that's what the Democrats always do. And then you read editorials in magazines like The Nation that lament the lack of spine and the incoherence of Democratic strategy. But the real reason is that this is a party of business that has to pretend otherwise for electoral reasons. And so their impulse is always to compromise to the right. And now that they had a challenge from the left, they really mobilized all their forces to fight it off.
I want to ask you a bit more about the Democratic Party. But before I do, you write in your essay about the right that the right has two primary effects. One is obviously to try and erode all the social gains of the past and be a kind of bludgeon. But another part is that the right transforms what's to the left of it, and you've just described that with the Democratic Party. To what degree has this whole right-wing backlash also shaped whatever's left of the actual left?
I think they've internalized a lot of it. The left has become very reluctant to talk up anything resembling centralized power. They've really gotten into the small is beautiful ethic. They've become, at least substantial portions of the left, have become very suspicious of state power. It's sounding a lot like Hayek in some places. I just did a review of Paul Mason's new book, his post-capitalism treatise, which is a vague and wordy thing, but it's remarkable how much of the logic of neoliberalism he just accepts as a given, and market relations. It sounds almost like Hayek at times talking about the virtues of the informational qualities of the price system. The idea that there's anything to be said for planning or something like centralization or social forms of ownership have disappeared in favor of this kind of decentralized, small is beautiful spontaneity. And we saw it, around the Occupy movement, an unwillingness to make demands, an unwillingness to be organized. That does seem to be part of the way that the left has just genuflected before the hegemonic power of the right. It's the right is a very, very powerful thing, and has proven so time and again. One of the reasons, I think, for the weakness of liberalism within the Democratic Party is that they have no left to co-opt or to dilute. They just feel very confident that they can brush it off and carry on with business as usual.
Well, you mentioned that the Democratic Party is, in effect, a business party that needs to pretend otherwise. And one thing that seems very striking when thinking about the class alignments of the ruling parties in the U.S. is that the Republican Party, although very explicitly the party of business, is really kind of embarrassing in many ways for big business. I mean, most CEOs, whatever we think of them, aren't going to come out with strange rants about evolution being a myth. So isn't the Democratic Party in many ways a better home just for your run-of-the-mill American capitalist?
Well, yes and no. One of the things that drives the business class and you know, the 1%, if you want to use that shorthand, is that they hate taxes and regulations. And sometimes it seems that that's all their politics come down to. A union economist told me this story back in the 90s. That he was talking to a couple of Fortune 500 CEOs and said, I don't really understand it. You know, the profits are booming and the stock market is booming, and yet all you people hate Bill Clinton. Why? He said he raised our taxes, is what these CEOs said. And I think that some of that spirit lingers today, that they just what they like about the right wing of the Republican Party. And even for a while, they enjoyed having the Tea Party as a battering ram for this, was the assault on taxes and regulations. That's pretty much all that motivated them.
Even though they're at historic lows.
Yeah, it can never get low enough from their point of view. And, you know, they don't want any regulations at all, basically. But on the other hand, you know, they're certainly most big business people, most big bankers, you know, your average Goldman Sachs managing director doesn't like creationism, doesn't like homophobia. Big business is fully embraces affirmative action and multiculturalism. Now, they don't really go with that, the Yahooism of so much of the Republican Party. That's where you see their base in the petty bourgeois, regional petty bourgeoisie, and that's where a lot of the instincts lie. They have a lot of, you know, billionaires here and there who fund, you know, people like Ted Cruz depend upon a handful of billionaires with very right-wing politics. You see some of these, like, hedge fund and private equity guys who are kind of, you know, they're not working for big organizations. They work for pretty small organizations. A lot of them are very libertarian, very reactionary, and willing to fund the Republican right. But, you know, like your average, you know, Goldman Sachs managing director or J.P. Morgan executive or you know, Fortune 500 executive would be most comfortable with somebody like Hillary Clinton. But there's always a threat that she's not enough of a tax cutter and regulation cutter just to make them completely happy. So they like to have Republicans maintaining the pressure in that direction.
So they can sort of have their cake and eat it too, have both parties and both.
Yeah, you know, there's this kind of back and forth thing where, you know, the Republicans come in and, you know, basically beat heads, and then the Democrats come in and consolidate the gains of the head beating period.
Doug Henwood is my guest. He is the editor of the Left Business Observer, and you can hear his program Behind the News on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and the program is Against the Grain. So I wanted to ask you, Doug, about what is in support of the right for so-called ordinary people, for working-class people. Do they support the right simply because of the racial politics? Is there something more to it? Because in terms of the agenda of the right, in terms of economics, for example, they're not getting very much.
Yeah, well, you know, there's the work. I mean, there's a lot of contradictory evidence here because there's really no evidence for a really serious rightward move among the working class, the white working class, outside the South. So the idea that the white working class has moved markedly to the right is not fully grounded in evidence. But there is a certain Republican base that votes that way. I think a lot of them tend to be small business people. That was certainly the roots of the a lot of the Tea Party activism was in small business small businesses. They're the ones who are least able to pay higher minimum wages and anything like resembling social benefits. That would be the material base for any kind of opposition to higher payroll taxes to pay for a public health insurance system. But there also is, to some degree, among ordinary people who vote for the right, I think an identification with the rich and the powerful. They by identifying with American imperial power, your life may be kind of you may take a lot of crap in your life and not have very much prestige, but you can identify with a country that can kick ass abroad. It wouldn't surprise me if a lot of the popular appeal of Donald Trump is just people want to be like a billionaire, that maybe some of that billionaire wealth will rub off on them if they vote that way. When I first started writing about political economy almost 30 years ago, I was a great believer in the power of rational thought and argument, that if, sort of under the influence of Noam Chomsky, if we just got the facts out there, things would take care of themselves. I've come more and more to believe that there are these, that politics is just really dominated by a whole set of fantasy structures that people vote aspirationally or through wish fulfillment or just of a desire to get revenge. It's not a whole lot of it is really thought out. Why would regular people support a repeal of the estate tax? Estate tax that might affect 1% of the population, yet the repeal of it had considerable popular support. People want to identify with the rich because maybe they will be too someday.
Or perhaps they don't realize that it actually only affects the very rich. The term the death tax is a real deflector.
Yeah, well, there's certainly the right is very clever at these phrases. The death tax is a stroke of genius. I'm not sure it's all fully informed or fully rational. There's an element of irrationality to all this that I don't really know how to get to. But I think that stoking class rage might be a way to break up some of those right wing fantasy structures. And I think part of the success of the Sanders campaign was to bring in a different set of a different way of thinking about politics and to channel people's discontent away from picking on immigrants and Muslims and towards picking on the very rich and the political class.
Well, speaking of channeling rage in the other direction, channeling rage toward immigrants and others, obviously that has been what has had a lot of the reason that Donald Trump has been propelled to where he is. But what strikes me as interesting about Trump is that although the U.S. has a long history of right-wing populism, one can think of Huey Long in the 1930s, Alabama Governor George Wallace in the 1960s and 70s. But over the last 40 years, it's been interesting that there hasn't been a right politics on offer that combines that seemingly anti-corporate, although not really, rhetoric with the xenophobia and racism. You see it very much in Europe, but it seems striking that until now you really haven't seen it in the U.S.
Yeah, we haven't really seen much of that. We've seen hints of it here and there. I guess George Wallace tapped into some of that. But that was before the period of real economic discontent developed. Trump's a bit of a lone wolf. He's not like, big business. He's not GM or Goldman Sachs. He's successfully tapping into some of that resentment. But we haven't really seen much in the way of that xenophobic anti-corporate kinds of politics that we've seen in Europe. But Trump does seem to have brought some of that in.
Sure. I mean, the focus on free trade and also the concern about your jobs being shipped overseas, obviously all framed in a very xenophobic way.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty successful melding of anti-corporate thinking and xenophobia, free trade. We don't want a free trade in goods, but we also don't want free movement of people either. It's just a classic nationalist politics of the sort that we haven't seen in the U.S. in some time. I guess we know we've seen hints of it in the past, but it hasn't gotten the kind of power and popularity that it has under Trump in a long time. And this is one of the reasons that, of course, movement conservatives find him so disturbing. They are generally pro-immigrant and even more enthusiastically pro-free trade. So his talk of building a wall with Mexico would make your average business person and also your average serious conservative very, very nervous. It's the opposite of exactly the opposite of what they would most like to see.
Well, obviously, it's hard to read the tea leaves, especially deep within presidential campaigns and all the spin that they send flying. But how do you assess the future of the right? Do you think, just to start with, that there is the danger that the right will end up self-destructing demographically?
Well, that's one hopeful sign. The demographics are encouraging for the left in a couple of ways. One is that the real hardcore of that xenophobic politics that is aging white Christians, who live in the sticks, and that is a weakening demographic force just as they move on to their reward in the sky. But and then we're also seeing a remarkable new generation taking place. The people under 30 or 35 are, by some accounts, the most most progressive cohort in the history of polling. They're just not just open to all kinds of cultural progress, but also a very receptive to socialism and social democracy. Yeah, so the younger people are thoroughly amenable to a much more social democratic politics. It was amazing to see a plurality of Iowa Democrats describe themselves as socialists. Frank Luntz was out with a poll recently showing younger people in particular very receptive to the idea of communism even. So it was, there's a remarkable shift, generational shift going on. And it's not visible just with the right. It's also seeing it in the Democratic Party, the Sanders voters who are mostly under 35, and then the older Democrats who are very aggressively supporting Hillary. But it does look like that kind of DLC conservative Democrat politics is running its last election, last presidential election. So who knows what will succeed it. But there will be a sharp fight within the Democratic Party in the coming years over how to shed that heritage of the Democratic Leadership Council, which is now, 25 years old, this agenda and its dominance of the Democratic Party. So I think there is a very encouraging demographic shift. So if you hit a combination of younger voters and the dying off of the older conservatives, then one hopes that the future could be a little better.
It's common for us on the left to see the right as much more unified than it is. And right now, of course, its lack of unity is really on display. Could you see the right fracturing?
Well, it certainly looks like the Republican Party is on the verge of fracture. The efforts of the elites to control the Trump insurgency are failing miserably. Now they're putting all their money on Marco Rubio. And it's certainly not clear that he's going to be their dream boat like they hope he will be. Trump is exciting passions that no other candidate in the race aside from Sanders has been able to excite. It's just fascinating to watch. The Democratic elite does seem to be in better control of the process than the Republicans are, but I don't know if that can last forever. But yeah, the fissures between the elites that have been able to run this Republican agenda while just really doing damage to a lot of this is the broader their broader electoral base. That whole game seems to be not working anymore. So it does seem like things are on the verge of cracking apart in the Republican Party. It's taken a long time, but you know, it's been what 35 years that since Ronald Reagan took over. And that whole conservative turn is getting pretty old. And 25 years since the DLC took over the Democratic Party, that whole thing is getting pretty old as well. And whatever you might you could argue that that rightward turn within the early 1980s and in the Republican Party in the early 1980s and the Democratic Party in the early 1990s. Was historically appropriate in some sense, that it was appropriate to a time of depressed profits and high inflation and declining U.S. prestige and power abroad. That doesn't seem like the current set of problems anymore. We are facing chronic economic stagnation, major climate crisis, and just a sense of general rot of our social and physical infrastructure. And the solutions of the right are not solutions at all for that set of problems. So it may have been whatever might have made sense, even in nakedly capitalist terms, 30, 35 years ago, just doesn't make sense anymore. But the political class and the political structure has yet to catch up to that changing reality.
Well, on that happy note, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Doug Henwood. He is the host of the weekly program Behind the News on Pacifica Radio. His latest book is My Turn, about Hillary Clinton. And he has an essay on the U.S. right in the latest Socialist Register. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.